This morning, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kurt Wiese, who is an infectious disease specialist here on staff at Boca Regional. Dr. Wiese received his medical degree from Cornell University Medical College in New York. He did his residency at the University of Virginia Medical Center in Charlottesville and a fellowship in infectious disease at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He is board certified in infectious diseases, and he currently, again, is in private practice here in Boca and in Delray and Boynton Beach. It is my pleasure to welcome him to give us a talk this morning on influenza.
Okay, thank you for your attention. Can everybody hear me? I also want to let you know that for those of us here in the Boca Raton auditorium, flu shots are being given out in the lobby. And for those of you procrastinators who haven't had one yet, Joanne Wade is out there. So thank you very much. Let me see if I can make sure this thing works here. So influenza is an old topic. It's been around for many, many years. And I'm going to try to touch on some of the past histories, what's going on currently in science, and maybe touch briefly on what to be expected in the future. So we can go all the way back over 2,000 years to Hippocrates. And he first described what we think might be the symptoms of influenza around 400 BC. He wrote several books. I actually haven't read these books because they're in Greek, but of the epidemics was written and includes epidemics. And there were several in there that resemble influenza. Dr. Hirsch, back in the 19th century, tabulated about 300 outbreaks of illness, and they were thought to be potentially influenza. But the first clearly recognized outbreak of influenza was in 1510. There was an article written, let's see, do I have a pointer here? There's an article written in 2010, a few years ago, by authors at the NIH and NIAID, celebrating influenza's 500th anniversary. I'm not sure if celebration is the right word, but the first clearly defined and clearly recognized outbreak was in 1510. So it's been around for a long time. It's been studied intensely for the past 100 years. It's going the wrong way. There we go. So, virus, the word virus comes from the Latin word for poison. Back in the old days, people didn't understand what a virus was. They just thought it was like a poison, hence the word. To be virulent means to be poisonous. But where does the name influenza come from? That's from pretty much from the Middle Ages. Influenza celestiale is a Latin or a Italian term, which means the heavily influenced, or the influence from the skies. In another word they used in Italy, influenza del freddo, influence of the cold. So influenza means an influence. Back in the Middle Ages, if your donkey died, you felt, you know, you were being punished for something you did wrong. Or if your child became ill, it's because you weren't in church enough or something like that. So people would actually believe that way, and that's where the word influence or influenza comes from. So this is a very small virus. It's in the Orthomyxoviridae family, and it's, like all viruses, extremely small. So 1/10,000th of a millimeter, you can pack an awful lot of viruses into a very small space. This is an electron microscopic view of the virus. What you can't tell very easily is on the surface there are spikes here. I'm going to talk more about those in a little while and how they play a role in what's important in the transmission of the disease. Oops. Going away. So basically, my outline for the talk is going to go talk a little bit about epidemiology, the statistics, clinical description of the disease, although most of you pretty much know that already, it's pretty obvious, treatment options, a little bit of molecular biology and pathophysiology, viral mutation, that's a key point in why the virus keeps being a repeat offender. The history, I'm going to go back to 1918, which was the biggest epidemic in the world ever. And then talk about birds, swine, and humans and how they interact with influenza A. And then talk a bit about influenza vaccines if I have time at the end. Okay. So influenza A, like I mentioned, has been around for a long time. In the USA alone, there are estimated to be 15 to 20 million cases every year in the USA. Now, that sounds like a big number, and it is. Most of the people that get influenza, like those of us in this room, hopefully would get it be sick for a few days, maybe miss some work, but get over it. There are hundreds of millions of cases worldwide. Because the elderly and the very young are more susceptible to complications, there actually are quite a few deaths. And they're estimated to be about 500,000 deaths due to influenza, directly or indirectly, worldwide every year. The majority of those are outside the USA, but here in the USA, we have 30,000 to 40,000 deaths every year attributed directly or indirectly to influenza, usually from complications in the elderly, but not always. So for the general population, every one of us has about a 1 in 10,000 risk of dying from influenza every year. But obviously, those numbers are higher if you're elderly or complicated. The cost of illness is not just from the cost of medication or the cost of hospitalization or the doctor's bills. That's about 20% of medical costs for influenza. 80% of the cost to society from influenza has to do with loss of productivity, not going into work, and then also the post-viral period where you're just too fatigued to do anything. But if you look at that number, it's estimated $10 billion a year in cost to the USA. Around the world, obviously, it's higher. The 1918 virus, which I'll touch on, was the most virulent ever, and it's estimated if we had a similar virus to that in current times, the cost would be around $700 billion and drop the GDP. So Wall Street understands this stuff, and Washington, D.C. understands this stuff, that if we had a really, really bad virus, if it was ever potentially weaponized, for example, and people do talk about that, that it might be very, very bad. So let's go back to 1918 and just see what it is that scares these people so much about the influenza. It's called the Spanish flu, and I'll touch on why it's called the Spanish flu in a little while. This was 1918. It was the third year of World War I. It was raging. Woodrow Wilson was the president. People did not understand what the virus was. Viruses had not been isolated. They had not been seen. They had been theorized from filterable infectious agents that were smaller than bacteria, but no one really understood what the virus really was. 1917, 1918 was a record cold winter. We're not sure if that really played a role or not. Some theories will support that. We don't really know. So, how did it all start? It's very interesting. There's been some very clever and some very interesting epidemiologic studies that have gone back to that time. So nothing was really out of the ordinary until 1918, in the early part of the year, January and February, in Haskell County, Kansas. Kansas. And that's over here down by Dodge City. Dodge City is pretty much the Wild West at that time. And there was an increased number of cases of influenza, some of them very, very severe, and more deaths than usual. So this doctor, Dr. Loring Miner, he was about 60 years old at that time. He'd been in practice in that area since 1885. He's an Ohio native originally, but had been living out there for many years. I suppose when he moved there in 1885, it really was the Wild West. But he apparently was a notable character in town, kind of a Doc Holliday figure, the only doctor for two counties. Got her on horse and buggy, but I believe in 1918 he actually owned a car. Interesting story to read about. It was very much rural out there. They didn't have much electricity. They did have one telephone in town. And he was noticing an increased number of severe influenza of all age groups and more deaths than usual. So what did Loring Miner do? Aside from, he was a heavy drinker too, by the way, but apparently his patients loved him. So he reported a number of cases, what he called influenza of the severe type. He contacted the U.S. Public Health Service. Apparently, that information didn't go anywhere. It was really the only warning of its kind for 6 months in 1918. Later, meaning like 4 or 5 months later, a small blurb was reported in what's called Public Health Reports at the time. That later became MMWR as we know it. This is the first hint that there was a severe virus adapting to humans. There's more information on that. Veterinarians also noticed that there was influenza in pigs. Veterinarians also didn't know what a virus was, but they knew this syndrome, and it was economically important, so they took notice of it. The next influenza outbreak that really got a lot of notice was about 250 miles east of Haskell County. Now, mind you, it's World War I. There's a lot of troop movements back and forth. Recruits are moving from all over the country, including Haskell County, Kansas. There's some very interesting reports about some of the young soldiers going back and forth on the trains because they've saved all the old local newspapers. So it's suspected that a virus transmitted or transported probably on a troop train or a recruit train across Kansas. So the next influenza outbreak was at Camp Funston in Fort Riley. That's near Topeka. It's at the conjunction of the Republican and the Smoky Hills River. Again, there's been some very good detective work going back on this. March 4th, 1918, a cook named Arthur Mitchell reports in sick. Now, of course, he's a cook. He's been serving people for the last 2 days. Okay. Within 3 weeks, over 1,000 soldiers are hospitalized, not just ill, but hospitalized, and thousands of others are quite ill. Influenza is very contagious, as we know. And it's felt very likely that the timing of the Camp Funston explosion strongly suggests that the influenza outbreak there came from Haskell County. Now, so what's this cantonment doing? Cantonment is an army camp. They're training soldiers to go to World War I. And, of course, they're coming and going continuously, usually by rail. This is a picture, an actual picture taken during that outbreak with, looks like, a couple of hundred of sick soldiers in one of the barracks from that building we showed you before, buildings. Frank McFarland Burnett, who was a Nobel laureate, he didn't win his Nobel Prize directly influenza. He's the gentleman that figured out how to use embryonated eggs to culture influenza and hence produce vaccines. That's probably his biggest claim to fame that we can remember him for. But he lived through the pandemic early on. He studied influenza most of his career, and he stated, "The evidence is strongly suggestive that the 1918 pandemic began in the U.S., and its spread was intimately related to war conditions, soldiers moving back and forth and obviously close quarters, that sort of thing, and especially the arrival of American troops in France." Okay, let's get back to the present for a while. Influenza comes in different types, actually more than this, but A, B, C, and D is easy to remember. The one I'm spending pretty much the whole talk talking about is influenza type A. That's the one that's severe and can be transmitted or shared back and forth between fowl, swine, and humans. It has to do with the receptors, and I'll touch on that in just a few minutes. Type B can be transmitted from humans to certain animals. Type B is a much milder illness. We had a gentleman hospitalized just a little over a week ago, COPD with influenza B. He wasn't that sick, but it was enough to buy him a couple days in the hospital. And then type C, people can get, but probably wouldn't even notice it. It's so mild. And there's a recently recognized type D, which only affects cattle. There's some other subtypes affecting other animals, but I'm not going to talk about those. The natural host for influenza A, are birds. Primarily waterfowl, but any bird can get it. So when we talk about that, that's the natural host out in the world. Influenza A either has been bird flu or avian influenza at one time all the time. Now, it's a little different. The glycoprotein receptor for the influenza A in birds is primarily in the GI tract. So it reproduces in their GI system. In humans and in pigs, it reproduces primarily in the respiratory tract because that's where the receptors are. So when birds have influenza A or are transmitting it, it comes out in their waste. And where do birds go? All over the world. So wherever there are birds, there's a potential exposure to to influenza A. Okay, let's do a little science here. This is a cartoon of the molecule of the virus. I want to point out two things here on this. The yellow structure on the surface is supposed to represent the neuraminidase. That's the NA or the N in the influenza nomenclature. And the blue is the receptor, the hemagglutinin. That's what attaches to the host cell surface to initiate the infection. If you look inside, there are 8 pieces of RNA. It's an RNA virus. There are 11 genes, only 11 genes. That's not a whole lot. But 8 pieces of RNA, 11 genes. And that little bugger can cause a lot of trouble. Let's talk about genetics. So it's an RNA virus. Only 11 genes on 8 pieces of RNA. In its reproduction, it can mutate quite a lot. As you probably know, RNA viruses are single-stranded. They mutate much greater than the DNA virus would, and that mutates much more than bacteria and obviously much more than eukaryotic cells, that's you and I. Since influenza A lacks a proofreading enzyme, Mutations occur about 1 out of 10,000 bases. That's about the length of the genome. And therefore, just about every virus comes out with one mutation, one base mutation, I should say. That has led to the concept of what they call the mutant swarm. Now, that sounds like a title to a bad movie, but what it means is that so many viruses are being produced that there are so many mutants out there that this leads to the potential for adaptation and change very, very rapidly. In fact, it's felt that probably the majority of viruses reproduce in every cell that it does reproduce in probably aren't even that aren't that virulent. But it doesn't take that many to be virulent to cause problems. What this means is that it leads to variable virulence in the virions. It's also highly adaptable because it mutates so much. It also means that occasionally influenza A can cross species. Now, influenza A, as I mentioned before, pigs, birds, and humans. And it can jump species sometimes, particularly where those cohabitate. The 2009 outbreak of H1N1 was a milder virulence, but it came from a triple reassortment of avian, swine, and human influenzas. Now that we have the capability of molecular biology and doing genetic work, the scientists can figure this out. Back in 1918, they couldn't do that, so it's not really clear, but it's felt that 1918 was an avian origin. There also are two concepts which you need to hear about, actually three different ways that mutations can happen. Antigenic drift and shift are fairly common, and reassortment is much more rare but causes pandemics. Drift is when you have a slight change in either the neuraminidase or the hemagglutinin. In this cartoon, it shows the hemagglutinin changing from one type of a triangle to a smaller triangle, and that's a slight drift, and sometimes the immune system will recognize that and you'll be immune to it, sometimes lesser virulence. A shift is a more serious change in either the hemagglutinin or the neuraminidase, and like, for example, from a triangle to a square, where the immune system does not recognize it. And then that can cause a much more virulent infection. Reassortment is the other thing I just mentioned. That comes from when you have actually more than one virus combining. For example, in this case, we have an H3N2 that's in a pig, an H1N1 in a human. If rarely what happens, what they call a mixing vessel or a subject animal, that animal could be a human being, gets an infection simultaneously from two viruses, these two can then combine within that animal, and then that can lead to, going the wrong way here. Nice clicker is playing tricks on me. What happens then is that this reassortment leads to a new virus, which could be potentially much more virulent. It could be potentially much less virulent, too. We don't know. That happens on rare occasions. That has been reproduced in a laboratory. It's felt that that's probably what leads to pandemic viruses on rare occasions. Okay, now forward. This is another example of the same phenomenon. A pathogenic avian strain and a human strain somehow combine, usually in a third animal, or that could be human, a bird, or a pig, to create a highly pathogenic human strain. This is what's feared from the H5N1. There was an outbreak in the Orient a few years ago where they had to kill about 10 million chickens. That was economically very important, but that's the fear, that this will happen, that it could somehow adapt and be more respiratory transmitted. Right now, that's not such a big deal. This is a complicated slide, and this has to do with how actually the virus infects a cell. So bear with me for a minute here. I'll try to take you through it. I'm not going to touch on all this. This is a little scary to me, too. All right, in the upper left-hand corner, you see a cartoon of the virus itself with the hemagglutinin. That's the orange, I believe. It sticks to the surface of a cell. In this case, let's call it a respiratory epithelial cell in a human. It causes cell adhesion. There's an endocytosis. An endosome forms, and then this opens up, and it releases the contents of the RNA of the virus. The RNA then has to go into the host cell, be reproduced to form both proteins and more RNA. Then it forms a budding. And to add insult to injury, the budding actually uses some of the host membrane to form its own new virus. A key part for budding is the neuraminidase. That's the virus. It's a protease that cleaves. Remember, you have to attach with the hemagglutinin, which attaches to the sialic acid on the glycoproteins of certain cells. if you don't cleave that, then the virus, the new virus doesn't go anywhere. So you have to cleave that. Neuraminidase inhibitors are, for example, Tamiflu. That's a key part of the infection to produce new virions. Obviously, we want to stop that, and we can stop that with certain medications. So as I mentioned before, the influenza A can only reproduce in the respiratory tract of humans and swine. It reproduces primarily in the GI tract of birds. But influenza A can infect any one of these, but we don't always cross species because they're usually host-specific, but not always, usually. on the last line of the slide, it says it infects white blood cells, but it cannot reproduce in them. It just kills those cells, and that explains why we have a low white blood cell count in at least in this viral infection. It can happen in other viral infections too, but particularly in influenza. That also explains some other phenomena that goes on with this there. So then, if influenza only multiplies in the respiratory tract, why is it such a systemic illness? We all recognize the case of influenza: high fever, headache, myalgias, arthralgias, cough, sore throat, confusion, anorexia, malaise. You feel lousy. Patients feel lousy all over. It's not just a respiratory illness. If a person comes in with primarily just respiratory symptoms, it's not going to be influenza. Influenza is a systemic illness primarily with respiratory symptoms as a secondary issue, even though it reproduces in the respiratory tract. So these people look bad, they're dehydrated, they're sick all over, and they need help. So this is why the illness has systemic symptoms. Influenza kills white blood cells. What do white blood cells have? They have endotoxins. Endogenous pyrogens, and these are released, causing fever and other problems. Those pyrogens plus the influenza virus itself are probably one of the most potent inducers of cytokines, including interferon. Interferon alone can give you an influenza-like syndrome. You feel lousy, you have all those myalgias, fever, headache. Other cytokines, TNF, interleukin, etc., also create that syndrome, that systemic syndrome of inflammation and feels lousy. The virus rapidly multiplies. It multiplies in 9 or 10 hours per cycle. That's pretty fast, even for a virus. And since it's going so fast, it can overwhelm the immune system, at least in the first few days, and you feel sick as a dog. Let's go back to 1918 again. So the Spanish flu pandemic killed more people than any other disease in history. Now, that's easy to forget, but it's estimated that 50 million plus people died worldwide in 1918 and 1919, an awful lot of people, more deaths than all the wars put together. The unique thing about that virus was that it affected younger people. The majority of deaths were under 65. Influenza now, with complications of pneumonia primarily, usually is a disease of the elderly. It was an H1N1. 1918 was given the number one for both the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, because it was the first well-studied virus, even though they didn't know it was a virus at the time. They didn't understand it. Avian origin, greatest pandemic. It killed more people in 1 year than the bubonic plague killed in 100 years. And actually, the majority of deaths were over about a 2 or 3 month period in the fall and winter of 1918, early 1919. That's pretty amazing. It was scary. This slide down here, which says 370,000 killed in the U.S., that was about halfway through the epidemic. The ultimate number at the end was about 600,000 for the U.S. So why was 1918 so bad? What can we learn from that? It was felt to be a double antigenic shift, both the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase. That's the H and the N. The previous virus, as judged by old serology, was found to be an H3N8. There was a lack of immunity in the younger population. Like I said, most deaths were in people under 60. Loring Minor, the doctor in Haskell County, Kansas, he was estimated to be about 60 years old. I couldn't find his exact age, but since he moved there in 1885, we figure he's in his 60s. He didn't get sick. He saw a lot of sick people. He didn't get sick. He probably had immunity. This strain was highly virulent. It multiplied much more rapidly than others. Its genome has been duplicated in the laboratory, and it reproduces 40,000 times more than the average influenza virus. Not sure exactly how it does that, but it does that. Back in 1918, people had a poor understanding of infectious disease. The germ theory was still not fully accepted, even though Pasteur had published and proven that several decades beforehand. As the last line says, all infectious disease was frightening at that time. You could die from a sore throat. You could die from a cut in your leg with a secondary bacteremia. Nowadays, we don't think about that. But back then, infectious disease was very, very serious and very threatening. So why do we call it the Spanish flu? That's an interesting little tidbit. newspapers in most of Europe and the U.S. Were instructed not to report bad news. So they downplayed the flu epidemic, even though a lot of people were dying. But in Spain, since it was neutral, they were free to report. So in the early part of the epidemic, this is actually the first wave of the three waves of the influenza, King Alphonse XIII became seriously ill with the flu. He did recover, but he was sick for weeks. This was reported in the newspaper. It was picked up in other newspapers around the world, and that was the first real big highlight of that, and that's where the name comes from. It really wasn't the Spanish flu. It was the Kansas flu, but we call it the Spanish flu even today. So a lot of deaths in younger people. It's estimated that anywhere from 3 to 5% of the world population died. There are stories you can read that are just astounding of entire villages being wiped out in Canada or in Africa, some of the lesser developed areas. Even our own Sir William Osler caught the virus in the third wave. That was in 1919. He developed pneumonia, got empyema. They tapped his lung. He was in Britain at the time. He ultimately died in December of 1919. He was a very clever guy, as we know. Towards the end of his illness, he even said himself, "I've been watching this case for 2 months, and I'm sorry I shall not see the postmortem." After the influenza, there was another phenomenon called encephalitis lethargica. That was really commented on. There were actually articles written on it in the journals of the time. And it was a real phenomenon. Although we don't think of influenza being neurotropic, it probably does have some effects like that. There are multiple cases of influenza with fever, not just in children, but in older people having neurological syndrome. And we now call this post-influenza asthenia. It's called the blahs after you've been ill. You get over the illness, you just don't feel right for a while. That's a real phenomenon. Some people call it chronic fatigue if it lasts longer. I'm not sure what to call it, but asthenia sounds good. This is the death rate in 1918. That spike along the younger people, ages from teenagers up to the mid-40s, is not typical. That's 1918. The typical curve is that deaths are usually in the very young or very old. The second wave in 1919 had a spike that was about half as high. So if it hadn't been for 1918, 1919, meaning the third wave of the virus, would have been the greatest pandemic ever. How is this virus transmitted? Well, I think we all kind of have a pretty good idea how it's transmitted. Large particles when you sneeze or cough, small particles just from breathing or just from clearing your throat, can be aerosolized and remain suspended in the air for quite some time. Direct contact, you can get it that way. Researchers back in 1918 kind of had an idea that you could get it just about anyway, and it survives quite a while in certain circumstances. It can survive on hard surfaces for a couple of days. If there's mucus present that then dries, that seems to protect it, and it can last for a couple of weeks. On the human skin, it doesn't last very long for some reason. I don't know exactly know why. Hopefully we're washing. And if it's frozen, it can last for decades and decades. That was proven when they exhumed some 1918 victims and took out the virus and the RNA and used reverse genetics to try to reproduce the virus, and they did that. So we know that the virus can stay forever. It's frozen. That's one of the theories why winter, maybe the virus is more virulent, because wintertime it lasts longer. The infection and shedding of the virus can happen within 12 hours of exposure. Now, you're not sick at 12 hours, but you actually have the virus. It reproduces in your respiratory epithelium cells, and like I said, 9 to 10 hours is a reproduction cycle, and then within 12 hours, those are bursting. If you just clear your throat, you maybe Dr. Zettner takes a mouthful of coffee and coughs a little bit, the guy next to her all of a sudden gets exposed to influenza A, and she doesn't even feel sick and won't feel sick for 2 days yet. That's part of the key to why influenza A is so bad. You can have it, transmit it for a couple of days before you actually get sick from it. That's a problem. Symptoms usually start on day 3, but you're contagious on day 1/2. Viral shedding continues for up to a week. Little kids shed more for some reason, and they're little virus factories. In certain studies, they've seen that 33% of people can be asymptomatic. You don't have much symptoms in the way at all. Well, how do you test for those people? They also transmit the virus. Another reason why the influenza epidemic is so hard to control, because a large proportion of people can be asymptomatic, either from partial immunity or from just having a milder syndrome. So what does this mean? This means get your flu shot, because there's no way of knowing who's sitting next to you. It's amazing how many particles of virus can be coughed up in one sneeze. One sneeze can contain 500,000 virus particles. 500,000 one sneeze. Imagine that. Why is influenza seasonal? A lot of theories. We're not really sure. Northern hemisphere, where we are, it's in the in our winter. Southern hemisphere, it's in their winter. In the tropics, it's year-round. Do we really know why? Theories about airborne survivability, cooler temperature, it lasts longer, that's true. Ultraviolet light, there's less ultraviolet light in the wintertime. Vitamin D levels, again, related to light exposure. Behavioral crowding in schools, and in the wintertime, you're crowding together. That was a factor, you know, in the barracks during the war, of course. The real answer is we don't really know. And there's probably a Nobel Prize in there someplace, if you can figure it out. Testing for influenza. We have a couple different tests. The one that you all know is the rapid antigen test, which is the nasopharyngeal swab. That's a pretty good test. It's not 100%. Has anybody ever here seen a false negative? They do happen. You know, the rapid antigen test averages, say, 70%. It's probably a little higher than that now. It's probably 80 to 90%, but it's not 100%. PCR test is much higher reliability, but it takes longer, it takes a few days, it's expensive. They don't do it on site here, so it's not so good. A viral culture is the gold standard, but the only people that really do that is the CDC or a reference lab. It's a clinical diagnosis. We talked about the clinical syndrome. We all recognize influenza. Loring Minor back in Kansas did not need a nasopharyngeal swab to diagnose the flu in 1918. If someone comes in with what looks like the flu during flu season, it's probably the flu. Okay, let me move on to vaccines. How are we doing on time here? Vaccines have been developed over many years. I mentioned the Nobel laureate who developed the technique for embryonated egg culture. The ACIP and CDC both recommend vaccination for pretty much everybody. If you're alive and you're breathing, you should get a flu vaccine. And part of the reason for that is not so much to protect you, but to protect the person next to you. And that actually holds true, because if you don't have a flu shot and you get the flu, you go visit your grandmother, you may not be sick, but you may be carrying the virus because you're not sick for a couple days while you still have the virus. You give it to your grandmother who has COPD, you go back home on Monday, 3 days later she's got the flu and she wonders where she got it from. The flu shot protects you and your loved ones, and for us healthcare workers, we should probably all get it unless it's contraindicated from an egg allergy. Currently, there are three main vaccines available. Let me talk a little bit about each one of them. They're all more similar than different. There are two trivalent vaccines, the regular trivalent and then the high-dose trivalent. These currently have in them an H1N1, an H3N2, and a influenza B virus, both of the same. Except for the high dose has, I believe, five times more of the antigenic material. The high dose, who do you give the high dose to? There are some studies that show increased immunogenicity in all age groups, but it's felt to be of significant benefit to those over 65 and those on statins. Why statins? Good question. Statins are felt to have some anti-inflammatory response or effect, and it's felt that it may be helpful to give the high-dose vaccine in those on statins. That's a trend, not scientifically proven, but the general recommendation is if you're going to give it to those over 60 or over 65 who are on statins. Those are the preferential group. The quadrivalent vaccine doesn't have much additional benefit. There's one more influenza B in there, and that's really only of use for people who are very high risk for influenza, like your bad COPD years. People who are very immunocompromised, they might benefit from an additional little extra vaccine. We don't use this very much. It's more expensive and it's not as readily available. There are a number of other vaccines out there, recombinant, egg-free, the live virus. The live virus, which is the nasal inhaled one, is not recommended. It's not recommended this year. I think it's not recommended at all ever anymore. It's felt to be less immunogenic, less protective. So that really is not being used anymore. The annual effectiveness of vaccines ranges from very poor, it's been as low as 10% in some years, if there's a mismatch between the selected vaccine and the viruses that are circulating in the wintertime. But it can be as high as 70%, as high as 70%. That's still not 100%. We've all seen people who've had a flu shot and get the flu. It can happen to anybody. That tends to be more likely in people who have who are a little older or are immunocompromised, have a weaker immune system. So how are target viruses selected? Well, obviously, the World Health Organization is doing worldwide surveillance. It's actually very complicated how they do this, and I'm not going to go into it because it's beyond the scope of this lecture. But there are many, many laboratories around the world. There are actually 92 laboratories currently involved in what's called FluNet, where they isolate between 150,000 and 200,000 influenza viruses, and then they all report to the World Health Organization, some of the central labs there. The strains are picked in February for the coming fall. That's more than 6 months in advance. Influenza vaccine for the southern hemisphere was just selected within the last few weeks. Obviously, they're 6 months apart from how we are here in the northern hemisphere. So of the vaccines I mentioned on the previous slide, which ones should you give to the patient? Only UpToDate says anything of any preference compared to all of them. UpToDate says give the high dose to those over 65, especially on a statin, as I mentioned. Other than that, the real recommendation is whatever you have on the shelf, if you got somebody in your office, give them a flu shot. To try to wait for something more specific is probably not useful. And almost all of the flu shots given are the trivalent, the regular one. I'm not going to go into this busy slide. I'm showing it to you just as an example. This is from the World Health Organization about how they produce or how they recommend a vaccine. This isn't vaccine production. This is just vaccine selection for what's going to go into the vaccine for the following year. And it's quite involved with cell cultures and animals and laboratories. And this is from the WHO site, their FluNet site, which is actually fairly interesting if anybody is so inclined. Well, with all the information I've told you, why would people not want to get a flu shot? I don't know. People, I get almost every week people say, oh, I don't want a flu shot. I don't want to get the flu, or I don't want to get Guillain-Barré, or I don't want to, you know, have whatever. So what are the real risks? This actually has been studied pretty thoroughly, and there's data out there if anybody wants to discuss it with people who are refusing a flu shot. Local reactions can be as high as 50% depending upon the vaccine strain each year. This year we've heard Dr. Rubin mention that some of his patients have had a higher incidence of local reactions and, you know, febrile reactions. Hopefully that means they're getting a better immune boost there. But the systemic symptoms from the vaccine generally are no higher than placebo, and that's been in multiple studies that prove that. The big thing that people talk about is Guillain-Barré syndrome. There were increased incidence of cases in the swine flu of the 1960s with the vaccine campaign there. So what's the real risk from that? The real risk with the influenza vaccine is about 1 in 1 million for getting Guillain-Barré syndrome. That's not zero, but it's kind of low. Let me go back here. What's the risk if you get the flu? Okay. If you get the risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome in the general population is about 10 to 20 out of a million in the general population. That's actually higher than the risk from the vaccine, just in general population for getting Guillain-Barré. Now, since the flu is a virus, viruses can trigger Guillain-Barré syndrome, as can other immunologic things. If you get the flu, your Guillain-Barré risk increases by another 1 in 100,000. And if you get the flu, as we mentioned before, the death risk is 1 in 10,000. Okay, so flu shot risk, 1 in 1 million. If you get the flu, you could either die or you could have an increased risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome that's actually higher than if you get the flu shot. That's if you get the flu. Now, if you roll the dice, you don't get the vaccine and you don't get the flu, okay, well, you win that way. So that's what people are betting on. Those are the numbers. Those are the real numbers. All right, so let's go back and take a look at this cartoon again. Remember, the flu shot targets against the neuraminidase and the hemagglutinin, the attachment factor and what helps to release the virus. Okay. Influenza treatment. This is very interesting. When we first had amantadine, that seemed to help very much. What this does, this inhibits viral uncoating, and I'll show you a picture. Actually, I'll go right now and show you. Viral uncoating. This is where amantadine works. After you have endocytosis of the virus particle, to release the particle, to have it open up and release the RNA, you have to have uncoating. Amantadine and rimantadine, come on. Amantadine and rimantadine inhibit that uncoating. But unfortunately, resistance has developed to those amantadine compounds, and so they've fallen by the wayside. We hardly use those anymore. But the neuraminidase inhibitors still seem to be pretty effective for influenza A and influenza B. We give them for a 5-day course. The zanamivir is the inhaled version, which is not used very much. It has to be inhaled. It has to have patient cooperation. It can cause coughing, and in people with lung conditions, it causes bronchospasm. So it's rarely used. It has been used, but it's rarely used. There's a new drug out there called paramivir. Has anybody heard of paramivir? Pharmacists? Okay, we got a couple of hands over here. It's probably horribly expensive. It's a one-dose intravenous drug only for influenza. I've never used it. I actually hadn't heard about it until about a week ago when I was reviewing a few things for this talk. Has anybody ever used it? I don't think so. I don't even know if it's readily available. But three drugs. Tamiflu, we know. Very few side effects. Well-tolerated. They work here. When you have budding of the new virion, the neuraminidase cleaves that attachment to release the virus. You block that, then the new virion is stuck on the surface of the host cell, can't go anywhere. That's the end of the story for the virus. So what would happen if we had a equivalent virus to 1918? There are articles published, kind of doomsday articles. It may not be quite so bad with modern science, but they estimate, this is estimated in current times, we could have 50 to 90 million people die worldwide. That's an awful lot of people. This is published in The Lancet. It's a reliable article. It may really happen. The WHO and the CDC take this stuff very seriously. Obviously, they're concerned about terrorist organizations and weaponization of the virus. That doesn't really seem feasible right now, but who knows? Interestingly, the currently circulating H1N1, which causes about 20% of current illnesses, H3N2 is causing about 80% of illnesses currently around the world. But the currently circulating H1N1 is very close to the one from 1918. 8 amino acids different. That's not a lot. It's kind of scary when you think about it. These policemen had the right idea wearing masks. These aren't really that protective because they could breathe through them, but it worked. Interestingly, when they exhumed some buried victims from 1918 and they reconstructed the viral genetics, they were able to use reverse genetics to generate the virus. This is an article out of CDC. These scientists in the CDC published in 2005 Science. It has a high growth phenotype. I mentioned that earlier. It grows at 40,000 times the previous virus. High virulence. In the lab, it causes death in mice and in embryonated chicken eggs. Most influenza strains don't do that. So it's a much more virulent strain. It's still not clear exactly why. In the CDC, they have these P4 laboratories that are very isolated, you know, very hush-hush places. You and I can't get hands on this virus, thank goodness. And they keep it locked up. A slogan came out of that for the CDC saying it's always 1918 at the CDC. They keep an eye on this. Hopefully they're doing the right thing. So does the current vaccine for H1N1 protect against the H1N1 of 1918? I don't know. I'd hope so, maybe. So scientists at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee, a number of years ago, found some elderly individuals born before 1915. All of them had antibodies against this reconstructed 1918 influenza virus, which they got from the CDC. And they also protected the mice from lethal infection. So it's interesting to know that 80 or 90 years later, your antibodies are still working. Okay, so there are some other influenzas of note. We've heard some of these in the news a few years ago, the avian flu, bird flu, H5N1. That was endemic in birds, primarily in the Orient. And It's around the world now, but it has not yet adapted to humans. There were a few in people who were heavily exposed in places like this. These young ladies, if there's avian flu in that room, you know they're going to get it. H9N2, H7N9, there are all kinds of viruses out there, most of which are not adapted to human transmission. The concern is, particularly with the H5N1, which did adapt temporarily, there were like about 20 deaths in the Hong Kong area. That's what led to the culling of millions of birds. The concern is that if it could adapt through mutation to transmission from human to human, that because that's a much more serious virus, that's more of problematic. The current H1N1 that's circulating is a milder influenza, if you can call it mild, milder than 1918 anyway, but it's easily spread, rarely fatal. The H5N1, the one I just mentioned, has a predilection more for the lungs, less for the trachea. Has to do with the receptors on the cells. There's more of them in the lungs. This is a spread slowly. It's not as contagious in a sense. You have to have a high inoculum to get the disease, but it's often fatal because it goes right to the lungs, and then you have either secondary pneumonia or ARDS from the primary infection. It's that bad. So this is a slide from 1918 on the back of a streetcar, which is the same slide I concluded with last year. It still holds true today. Cover your cough, be polite to your neighbor, get your flu shot. Okay, we flew through that lecture pretty fast. Nyuk, nyuk. I'll take any questions if you have them now. Thank you. Dr. Baca.
Availability. We're still waiting on our shipments. What I've noticed is that CVS and the Publix, the produce guy, get the shots before the doctors do because they order bigger things. But is there any information on what's going on? I see people complaining about it nationally because it seems like, you know, the produce guy does not seem to see as patients as lung doctors are, because I have immune suppressed patients.
We've noticed the same thing. I don't have an answer for that. But you're right. Some of the larger CVS or Publix places had their vaccines in August. And even hospitals sometimes didn't get them until mid or late September, a month later. It's marketing, I think, and money talks. I don't think that's right, and I agree. I know the IDSA has made a comment to that effect in a letter to, I'm not sure who, but Sean, you make a good point. It's not right, but it's true. I don't have an answer for that. The CDC and the ACIP recommend everybody gets a vaccine over the age of 6 months, regardless of immune status. It's a killed vaccine, so it's safe for anybody.
Right.
The only contraindication is a true egg allergy.
So
the high dose doesn't necessarily... The high dose looks like it's helpful in people over 65.
Right.
That's not really been studied or proven very well. And it looks like it increases the titers of antibodies. Does that generate any more protection? That's not been proven. Higher titers is not necessarily correlated with better protection, but that's the selling point for the high dose. I think you should do a study to that effect. Yeah. Unknown. I actually tried to find that answer. There's not enough cases, not enough known to know. Question in the back.
Yeah, what are your recommendations for patients on immunosuppressants?
Get the flu shot.
You hear me?
Yeah, get the flu shot. The only contraindication is an egg allergy.
HD?
There's no greater risk with the HD, so I'd say, yeah, if there's any concern about if they're over 65 on statins, don't know if being immunosuppressed falls in that category too. That's not been recommended or suggested by anybody, but if you can get it, that probably would make sense. But the answer is yes, vaccinate those people. Yes. I don't think there's any good scientific answer for that, but just because of the way people are with their MS and their exacerbations, I would wait till afterwards. But let them get back to a stable situation just so you don't exacerbate anything, because with MS, it's such a crazy disease also. You never know what triggers it. I would wait. Okay, once again, flu shots in the lobby if anybody needs one, and thank you for your attention.